He's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
And welcome. So great to have you with us today on this Saturday on the Faith Radio Network. Question to start off with, are all religions and worldviews equal? There are some that would claim they are. A worldview attempts to answer some of those fundamental questions of our lives. Why am I here? What does it mean to be human? Why is there evil in the world? And how do we deal with evil? But not every worldview places equal emphasis on each issue. Each of those worldviews that people grapple with and different faith traditions believe in has a different emphasis and a different central question. And we're going to be unpacking that this hour as we talk to an apologetics expert who's written a great new book called Grand Central Question, Answering the Critical Concerns of the Major Worldviews. And he'll be joining us here in just a few minutes on the Faith Radio Network. Our number, 877-93-FAITH. Why don't you jot that down? Because if you call us in the next 55 minutes or so, give us your contact info, name, address, phone number, email address. We'll enter you into a drawing for a copy of one of those books, Grand Central Questions. And we'd love to maybe get that to you, especially if you are in church leadership, maybe a small group leader, maybe you're a student in student ministry. This would be a great book for your library to study up on, because chances are all of us are going to come into contact with somebody who has a different worldview than we do. And how are we going to explain the Christian worldview in terms that they can understand? Again, 877-93-FAITH is the number. You can also go to our website, myfaithradio.com. Every week, I look at some family-related and health-related and psychology-related stories that are in the news, and I found one on college football players, of all things, this week. You probably heard about a lot of the controversy in the NFL regarding concussions and brain injuries. There have been reports that several ex-NFL players struggled with serious brain injuries following their career. Several of them committed suicide. And now a new study has taken this this research one step further, looking at college athletes. Dennis Dodd at CBSSports.com had a great story this week. It's on research showing that college football players who have suffered a concussion have significantly smaller regions of the brain related to memory. Now, this particular study was done at the University of Tulsa, and it looked at the hippocampus, a part of the brain that is very much involved with memory. And if it's damaged, a person can suffer disorientation, memory loss, in fact, even amnesia if you have extensive hippocampus damage. What they did at the University of Tulsa is they compared 25 of their football players who had a history of concussions to 25 students who had never played football. And Tulsa faculty member Patrick Belgowan says there are other studies that have evaluated the effects on older athletes, such as those retired NFL players I mentioned, but no one has studied 20-year-olds until now. And he says the results were astounding. The researchers found that the hippocampus in players with a history of concussions, 20-year-old athletes, that their hippocampus was 24% smaller than the non-athletes. And another troubling finding in this research, the more years that an athlete had played football, including in high school, the slower their reaction times. According to Dr. Belgowan, the next step is to figure out what caused the difference in the size of the hippocampus. One of the athletic trainers there who was involved in the research, David Polanski, says, he reminds us the research is correlational. The next step is to determine causation, so that long-term brain injury can be identified and prevented. But another indication, you know, I mentioned several of these stories. I think we talked about soccer players a few months ago. But more and more research now showing that concussions, that head injuries, even minor head injuries during contact sports may have long-term, significant long-term negative ramifications for these athletes. So keep your eyes on these studies, because if you've got a son or daughter who's playing in a contact sport, you need to be aware of it. Here's a completely unrelated story, but I thought it was pretty fascinating. Are pregnant women an accident waiting to happen? There's a new study out showing that 1 in 50 pregnant women will be involved in a serious motor vehicle accident, typically during the second trimester of pregnancy. This research was done in Canada. They looked at 500,000 pregnant women and examined their driving records before, during, and after pregnancy. They followed each of these ladies for, I think, 5 years, 4 years before delivery and 1 year after delivery. And they looked at whether typical conditions of pregnancy, such as nausea, fatigue, insomnia, distraction, were contributing to driver error and an increased risk of being in a crash. And what did they find? Well, women driving during their second trimester of pregnancy were 42% more likely to be in a car accident. Yikes! Professor Donald Reidelmeyer at the University of Toronto says, pregnant women often ask me about the safety of things like air travel and scuba diving and hot tubs. Yet many of them overlook traffic accidents, which are a greater threat during pregnancy. Now, the reason for this link isn't completely clear, but Professor Reidelmeyer speculates that during the second trimester, women may develop a false sense of security that's compounded by things like insomnia, back pain, and a more hectic life in general. He says, okay, these ladies have made it through the risk of the first trimester. Their minds are preoccupied with the birth of their child, and they're rushing around trying to get things done before the big day. It's easy for them to get distracted. Well, sure, trying to get that nursery ready to go, all those visits to Babies R Us. And because of that, Dr. Reidelmeyer emphasizes pregnant women need to consider safe driving as a part of their prenatal care. So if you are pregnant, especially in your second trimester, or if you know somebody who is, tell them to take it easy on the road. Man, no lead foot driving for pregnant ladies. You want to keep yourself and that little baby inside of you safe. It's 11 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Meyer, and this is the Faith Radio Network. And coming up next, we are going to tackle the grand central question that each of the major worldviews have. And how does Christianity answer that grand central question? Our guest, Abdul Murray, coming up next here on the Faith Radio Network.
If your marriage seems to have lost the old spark lately, maybe it's time to make a few changes.
Here's Dr. James Dobson for Family Talk.
You know, over the years, I've watched many happily married couples become bored and dissatisfied with each other simply because they forgot to take time out for fun. Without it, the never-ending responsibilities of adult life can become oppressive and deadening to a marriage. But to let it continue is to sacrifice something precious in your relationship. You can prevent that from happening by making a conscious effort to put four simple ingredients back into your lives. First, make a date with your spouse this week and leave the children at home. Now, I'm not talking about an expensive night out on the town necessarily. The point is just to get away for a short while and get to know each other again. Next, take time out for surprises. A note tucked in a briefcase or a phone call to say, I'm thinking of you. Third, reserve some of your time and energy for a meaningful sexual relationship. Fatigue and overcommitment are destroyers of erotic behavior, even among people who love and care for one another. And finally, try to remember that the most successful marriages are those where the husband and wife respect each other and communicate that respect every day that they're together.
Hear more at MyFamilyTalk.com. MyFamilyTalk.com.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer Live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer Live.
And I want to say hi to our great friends who are listening on Faith 1190 in Madison, Wisconsin. Maybe you are tuned in on Faith 1200 in Fargo-Moorhead or Faith 1270 in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Want to also just a word of appreciation to our great friends in Waterloo, Iowa, listening on Faith 1090. And if you're listening on Faith 90.5 in Duluth, Minnesota or Superior, Wisconsin, thank you for making us part of your weekend. And of course, to all of our friends tuned in throughout Minnesota on Faith 900, our flagship station in the Twin Cities. Thank you for making us part of your week and your weekend. My guest this hour is Abdu Murray, the president of Embrace the Truth International. He's also a visiting professor of Christian thought and apologetics for the Josh McDowell Institute at Oklahoma Wesleyan University. Abdu is the author of Apocalypse Later and a contributor to a number of books on apologetics and missiology. He's also the host of a Detroit area radio show called Embrace the Truth with Abdu Murray. And today he joins us to talk about his new book, Grand Central Question. And Abdu, welcome to Faith Radio.
Dr. Meyer, it's an honor to be on the show with you. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you for taking an hour out of your Saturday to join us. And before we dive into your book, can you tell us a bit more about your background? I know you have a law degree. How did you get involved in the field of apologetics?
Well, it's then from my background as a Muslim, actually, about 14 years ago, going on 14 years now, I became a Christian after a nine-year search into the credibility of the various worldviews, including and especially Christianity and Islam. I was a pretty serious Muslim, actually. I thought that people should believe true things and they shouldn't believe false things, and I thought that a true thing was Islam. And I wanted Christians to believe in it. So I spent a lot of time, even from a young age, engaging Christians in conversations that were theologically deep and historically, you know, going into the historical evidence for various worldviews. And I thought Islam was true, so it would stand up to the challenges. But I was challenging Christians as well. And for the most part, a lot of them didn't have really responses to my challenges, but some did. And thank God for them, too, because they got me thinking about the credibility of the gospel. I thought that every major Christian doctrine that forms the basis of the gospel was false because it insulted God's greatness. But over a course of years, like I said, 9 years, I began to see that the very doctrines I was rejecting actually are the ones that satisfy my intellectual search for to see if there is a God and who he is and how he exists, but also my emotional search to find ultimate fulfillment in a relationship with that God. So that was a nine-year search, and you know, I often say it, this is important to say, I think, when we look into apologetics, the answers weren't that hard to find, but they were hard to accept, and that's why it took 9 years.
Was there a particular turning point for you, Abdu? Obviously, you were on this search. As you said, you met some Christians who really didn't have the answers, others who did, and did they point you to places like, for example, C.S. Lewis or some of the modern day apologists? What was it that finally got you saying, you know, I can't deny this anymore?
Well, they did actually point me to some of those places. But you know what was interesting was the first real challenge. I had two real important challenges that came to my belief system, because as a Muslim, I believed, for example, that the Bible, the Quran actually says the Bible was God's revealed word. Mm. The five books of Moses, the Psalms of David, and the Gospel of Jesus were revealed by God to certain people, but then they became corrupted over time. And the Quran came to fix all that. Well, it was during these conversations with some Christians where they said, well, have you considered why you're a Christian or why you're a Muslim, I should say. And I had always been challenging Christians. Why are you guys Christians? And they would say tradition. Well, I began to read the Bible to find all the holes and the flaws in it. So these Christians who came to my door or who talked to me, I could nail them between the eyes with a contradiction or two, you know, that kind of a thing. But then I saw something in Luke chapter 3, verse 7. John the Baptist is talking to those who are coming to him, and he says, who told you to flee from the wrath to come? And don't even begin to think to yourself that you have Abraham as your father, as if that would save them from God's wrath, he was saying. For I tell you, God can raise up sons of Abraham from the stones. Now, it's interesting because here I am reading this chapter, reading this book, to not believe a word of it, because I thought it was corrupted. But then all of a sudden, those words hit me. He's saying tradition is not as important as truth. And I had finally been confronted, I think through the power of God's word, really, to confront the fact that I had thought of reasons to become a Muslim or to stay a Muslim, but the real reasons were tradition. And I began to look at things a little more credibly, a little more critically even, not just Islam and Christianity, but everything. And then I saw passages in the Quran itself that suggested that the Bible was not only God's revealed word, but it was not corrupted and could not be corrupted. And so I began to look and see, oh my goodness, what's the evidence here? So I got tuned into Josh McDowell and then Norm Geisler and some of the modern-day apologists, Francis Schaeffer, and all these folks, and started looking into the credibility of the text of the New Testament. And I saw that the history shows us it really hasn't been changed, which I would call, at that point for me, an inconvenient truth, what Al Gore might call it, because I had to make a decision between the gospel or Islam. And so, yeah, it got me going. The Bible itself, though, was the challenge. The Word of God is actually what got me thinking about these things more critically. And then I started to read the apologists and see that the Bible really had tons of credibility.
Now, the claims by Islam that the Bible, the scriptures have been corrupted, are they saying basically, you know, over the years in the first couple centuries that the original revealed word was somehow changed? And then did you go back and say, wait a minute, there's all these manuscripts from, you know, dating back from the first century that you know, are so close to the modern day translations, they couldn't have been corrupted. Was that part of your search?
It most definitely was. You see, what Muslims, you got to make a distinction between what Islam now teaches and what Islam in the early days actually taught. The Quran doesn't really say the Bible was changed. It refers to the Bible in very glowing terms, actually, and this is what really caught me off guard, because I had read it many times before, but never with this open mind that I had after reading the Bible. The Quran says, for example, in chapter 5, verses 46 to 47, that the people of the gospel, meaning Christians, need to judge by what God has revealed in the gospel, and those who do not judge by the gospel or what God has revealed are the rebellious or the evildoers. Elsewhere in the Quran, it refers to the Bible in glowing terms. And it has some allusion to the idea that it's been changed, but really what it's referring to is that the meanings have been hidden, or the Christians and the Jews have hidden certain interpretations of the text. But it never says, really, that the actual text has been changed. Hmm. But Muslims have invented this over time, and the reason is this. There really wasn't a Arabic Bible available in Muhammad's day or even for centuries after that. It was around the 9th century when an Arabic Bible was finally available, and Muslims had assumed that the Bible would line up with the Quran. And then they read it, and they're like, oh my goodness, it doesn't. Mm. Well, it can't be our Quran that's wrong, so it's got to be the Bible was changed. And so that's really when it became popularized over time. But then you look, like you pointed out, when you actually do a look and you say, well, if the Quran came to correct the corruptions, that means the Bible had to have been changed, have been corrupted from years before that. But all the evidence we have, from the nearly 6,000 manuscripts of the New Testament in Greek alone to the 25,000 almost manuscripts of the New Testament in other languages and the Dead Sea Scrolls and all this, not only is it not changed around Muhammad's day, it wasn't ever changed, really. I mean, it's so close to the original as to defy any claim that it's been substantially changed at all.
Hmm. Now, let me ask you, just from a personal perspective, obviously, when a Muslim converts to Christianity, not only are you changing your worldview and your religion, you're also leaving your culture, in many cases, leaving your family of origin, because in many cases, and I think that the current film God's Not Dead portrays this, where this young woman converts to Christianity. What happened to you with your own family, with your own mom and dad, when you made this decision?
Oh, sure. And I won't go into tons of detail, only because it's obviously pretty personal. But I'll tell you this. One of the reasons it took 9 years is because at some level, subconsciously, I knew the reason I won't accept these answers is because I can't, because of the consequences. Mm. I had formed quite the identity for myself as a strong Muslim, as a Muslim evangelist, as someone that other Muslims would come to with questions about Islam, even from an early age. So I would lose that identity. That was a big part of it for me, too. is that I would essentially have to commit a sort of suicide and become somebody totally different, you know, die to myself. Funny, I think that a Jewish guy 2,000 years said something about that. So I knew that, but I also knew that it would cost the culture, cost the community, cost a lot for me. And to some extent it did. At first it was pretty bad. I won't go into tons of detail, but it was pretty bad at first, and that loss of identity and all that, that really did happen. But the good news is this. I've always had a really strong family, and strong families can be a two-edged sword. Sometimes they're so involved that there's an emotional baggage to everything you do, but also the blessing is that we've come out of this, and we are still together, and we see them and talk, and, you know, there's a healing that's going on. But it was rough. It was rough at first. And in some degree, I had it easy compared to some Muslims who come to faith, even in the United States, I had to flee for their lives, and some of them even lose their lives.
Now, what about, I know you're married with children, what about your wife? Was she Muslim? Did you meet her after your conversion? What's the story there?
Well, I met her before my conversion, and she was actually a Christian. But when we were sort of going on our journey together, we weren't really dating per se, so much as her best friend married my best friend. So we had spent a lot of time together, and she was fascinated by the idea that I believed something different than her and what it was, and she didn't know a thing about it. So she began to study it and look into it. And as things became more obvious that we were going to move on in life together, we made a decision. We're not going to walk into a marriage or anything else not believing the same thing. We wanted to believe the same thing, and I was going to convince her to become a Muslim. And she said, well, I go where the truth is, and whatever's true, I follow.
Wow.
So I know it'll be hard, but I'll go with what's true. And I said, well, I promise I'll study Christianity, and I did. And over time, you know, our dates weren't always that romantic. It was a lot of debate. But we did it. I began to study lots and lots of things, and I wanted to be sincere in my search. She was sincere in her search, but completely independent of our relationship, really. I began to see how much evidence there was historically, philosophically speaking, and on a total worldview level. I really began to see, my goodness, this is really, really satisfying. And in fact, in some parts of the book, I go through, not in tremendous detail, but I think in enough detail to get the flavor of what I had to go through to kind of finally realize that if there's a God, then he's the God of the Bible.
Wow. Powerful, powerful personal story, Abdu. And obviously a man who knows Islam intimately and can probably debate with the best of them on this particular topic. And we're going to, Islam is just one of the worldviews we're going to be unpacking as we explore your book. Once again, the title of the book is called Grand Central Question, Answering the Critical Concerns of the Major Worldviews. And my guest is Abdu Murray. By the way, the foreword of the book, Josh McDowell, one of the better known or best known evangelists, I think, in modern day, and wrote a wonderful foreword for the book and got some great endorsements as well. Ravi Zacharias endorses the work, Sean McDowell, Gary Habermas. Just it's nice to hear some of the big names saying, read it. Must make you feel good.
That is rather nice. Josh and Ravi and Gary and a lot of them have become friends over the years. In fact, some of them I consulted while I was still on my search, and they were accessible, which was just amazing to me. I had questions and they had answers, and it was quite something, and it's just, I'm tickled pink. But how the Lord weaves these things together to see that not only they help me come to faith, but they're actually endorsing a book that in some ways they're responsible for because of their work in my life.
Beautiful. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back. If you have any questions for Abdu, feel free to give us a call. 877-93-FAITH is the number, 877-93-FAITH. And you can go to our website at myfaithradio.com and look for my show page. We've got a contact link there. We're going to take our break, and we'll be back in just a moment here on the Faith Radio Network. Stick with us.
Real encouragement for an active walk of faith. Podcast. right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. Our guest is Abdu Murray. He is the president of Embrace the Truth International and the author of this wonderful new book, Grand Central Question, Answering the Critical Concerns of the Major Worldviews, in which he really tackles three of them. And we're going to get into that in just a bit. In fact, in the prologue of the book, Abdu, you set up the rest of the book. You discuss how people of different worldviews deal with what you say is the conflict between being comfortable and seeking the truth. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is drawn in large part from my own experience, but also seeing the experiences of people from various worldviews. You know, in the first segment, we had discussed what it cost me to become a Christian. And that is certainly something that a lot of people face. A lot of Muslims face this. A lot of Hindus face this. It's interesting that Hinduism and Buddhism will claim to be very tolerant of other religions and even accepting of other religions. But just ask any convert from Buddhism and Hinduism how easy it went for them, and you'll see just how tolerant they really can be. Atheists, the same thing. There's tremendous prices people often have to face, whether it's emotional, because I'm angry at God, and if I say I believe in him, I'll have to let go of my anger, whatever it might be, or self-sovereignty. I quote in the book Thomas Nagel, a renowned philosopher at New York University, and he says basically that he denies God's existence because he doesn't want there to be a God. He hopes there is no God, in fact. And Aldous Huxley, another example, he actually abandoned belief because embracing a Darwinian idea of life allows him to be free to pursue his own erotic passions. You see this from all walks of life, both religious and non-religious. And these are the things that actually can obscure our quest for truth. So we can think we're on a look for truth. We can say we want the truth, but really, oftentimes, our intellectual objections, I should say, are masks for our real emotional objections that keep us from belief in God.
Mm. You know, that's fascinating. One of the things that I've learned, and I'm sure you found this in your own studies, it seems like in the case of many of the modern day, let's say, neo-atheists, a lot of them will admit that that part of their rejection of God may have something to do with the fact that they had a lousy relationship with their father, with their earthly father. And, you know, from a psychological perspective, that's not surprising if, you know, and that it could go either way. It could be, let's say, a dad who was very rejecting and harsh, or it could be a dad maybe who had a strong faith, but the faith tradition was lived out in a way that perhaps was hypocritical. And so this individual grew up and said, I want nothing to do with this, and I'm going to go 180 degrees against it. So oftentimes there is an emotional component to a person's belief. Now, that would also apply to Christianity in that you often find that people come from very difficult, painful backgrounds, and they accept Christianity because it provides for them a sense of hope. So that's not a bad thing, though, is it?
No, it's not. It's interesting you say this, too, because Freud, the atheist psychiatrist and father of psychoanalysis, actually said that belief in God is a manifestation of our daddy issues. Right. We have bad daddy issues, so we need to create a cosmic father who's perfect so he can sort of be our surrogate. So he's saying belief in God because of our daddy issues, so to speak, is false. Interestingly enough, as you pointed out, and as a lot of research actually shows, the opposite is also true. We reject God because of our daddy issues, so to speak. Mm. So it has neither here nor there with whether or not God exists. But there's an interesting study recently done, and I point this out actually in some bonus materials. If people buy the book and they go to grandcentralquestion.com, we have a free study guide and some free videos they can get if they go to the free bonus content and just give us their name and email address. We'll send them a link to this free bonus material. In this bonus material, in one of the videos, I talk about the study that was done by Julie Exline of Case Western Reserve University, where she studies emotional atheism. They did a survey of a number of college students, for example, and asked them to rate their anger level at God. And the people who scored highest in their anger level at God were atheists, self-proclaimed atheists. which begs the question, of course, or actually leads us to ask the question, my goodness, what are you mad about? Because if he doesn't exist, who are you angry at?
Exactly.
Hey, no one gets mad at unicorns. So there's something to it. There's something to it that is an emotional component of their disbelief. And I think it's this. It's not that they disbelieve in God. They disbelieve in God's goodness. That's the issue. And I think that if we can highlight what I try to show in the first section of the Bible, of the book, for example, is that when we look at the God of the Bible, we see a God who actually fulfills intellectually, objectively, and emotionally our need to have this, to have our needs met, both intellectually and emotionally, through the gospel, and the gospel alone, by the way.
Now, let me take you back to something you just said. There are many of these atheists rejecting God's goodness. Now, that seems like just the opposite of how it should be. I can understand someone rejecting God because they see him as harsh or overbearing or controlling, but rejecting his goodness, explain that.
Well, they would actually doubt that he actually is good. So they'd say that,
I know you want to
believe in his goodness, but they don't believe, like you, even the famous quote by Richard Dawkins, where he goes on and on and spills lots of ink telling us how awful God is. There's a lot of anger in that statement. He's a malevolent, pestilential, genocidal, tribal bully, so to speak. That's what he says. So an awful lot of anger at someone who doesn't exist. And I think this is true of our sort of common experiences among a lot of atheists. I can't tell you how many times I've sat across the table at atheists or done Q&As at speaking engagements where the atheists have given me an intellectual objection. And I take it seriously. I want to answer their question. But the Bible tells us in Colossians 4, we're not supposed to answer questions. We're supposed to answer people. People have questions. Questions don't need answers. People need answers. And so you uncover and unpack things, and you quickly begin to realize their intellectual objection is the sort of cover or the justification for their emotional objection.
Wow. And, you know, that is such a critical point, because I think there are a lot of Christians, and I'm sure you've met many of them in your own work. Mm-hmm. They're really good at making arguments. They, you know, have Josh McDowell memorized backwards and forwards, but they're not very loving, and they're not very winsome, and they really don't know how to have a relationship with someone outside of the faith, and therefore they kind of push people away. And you know, we have that scriptural mandate. What are we supposed to do? Yes, defend the truth, always be ready to defend the hope that lies within us, but do it with gentleness and respect. And so many people leave the last part of that verse from Peter out. It's gentleness and respect, friends. And it sounds like that's the way you operate, and Lord bless you for that, Abdu.
Well, I do operate that way, large part because that's how I was reached. You know, I'm a debater. I like to debate. But I recognized as a Muslim, and I recognize now as a believer, especially now as a believer. Again, what I said before is that questions don't need answers. People need answers to their questions. And if we understand where they come from, I mean, when you do Q&As, a lot of Q&As, and I'm sure on your show you get a lot of the same questions, worded the same way or the same content. But every question is actually uniquely different because a different person's asking it. So you can get a problem of evil question. And in fact, in the book, in the secular humanism section, I begin it by talking about this question a good friend of mine who was an atheist actually asked me about the problem of evil. But he made it a very personal problem. Now, I could answer him with all the philosophy of William Lane Craig and all this stuff, and I certainly did that. But then how do you do it in a way that makes sense and matters to that person? That isn't just a philosophical answer, because anybody can do that, but one that makes it matter to that person specifically. Uh-huh. I think that's a lost art. It is an art. It's not a science. It's an art. Mm-hmm. But it's one that is, I think, cultivated through prayer. Honestly, if we pray about how we engage non-believers, we can have a much more effective witness.
And ask God to soften our hearts to those people that may be somewhat difficult to love
Indeed.
At times. All right, let's look into the three worldviews that you tackle in the book. Secular humanism is first. And what is their grand central question? And then how does the gospel answer it?
Well, the grand central question for secular humanism, which is in large respect sort of the public face of atheism in terms of its the actual movement, the central question comes right from the name. Humanism is the idea that human beings have inherent dignity and value, and not just inherent, but objectively so. We can objectively know this, irrespective of human opinion. That's what humanism really is. But secular tells us that we don't need God for that. They're on a search to find out how can we objectively affirm human value and human dignity. And you see this throughout, and I quote a number of their passages from both their manifestos and the websites and the numerous books that they have, telling us that their central question is really the moral center for human value and human dignity. Now, the problem with that is that to affirm an objective human value, that human beings have value objectively, means that you can't depend on human opinion for that. Well, if you can't depend on human opinion for that, but human beings are the only or the last sort of word on moral pronouncements and intellectual pursuit, well, then it's, of course, subject to human opinion. It has to be based on human opinion. And human opinion, as history has shown us, about human value is horribly unreliable. It's just terribly unreliable. The Holocaust happened as a result of the actions of people who were in the most educated country in the world. Education doesn't do it. We're notoriously bad at affirming human value, and we're still bad at it. So something to be objective has to be beyond human opinion. But if it's beyond human opinion, then that source has to be transcendent of human opinion, and it has to be personal, because these ideas are personal ideas. Well, that sounds a lot like God. Now, any theist can say, yeah, that's the answer, that we need God to affirm objective human value and human dignity. And that's true, okay, on a theoretical level. But I think the gospel is uniquely suited to do this, beyond Islam, beyond Hinduism, beyond deism, beyond just good old good personism, theism, you know, good people go to heaven kind of a thing. The gospel tells us that we're inherently valuable, and it proves it to us. Because how do we know how valuable things actually are, as an example? We know how valuable things are by what we're willing to pay for them. Mm-hmm. And the gospel tells me that I am, and you are, and all of your listeners, and everyone who's in the world, is immeasurably valuable because God was willing to pay an immeasurable price on the cross to spend an immeasurable eternity with all of us. And that's objectively true because of history, and it's theologically true because of what the gospel tells us, and it's philosophically satisfying because that is the way to ground our objective moral value.
Now, it would seem to me that a secular humanist wouldn't have a problem with the fact that, you know, hey, that's a great add-on. You know, if there indeed is a God, and indeed if he did send his son to die for us, boy, that gives us even more worth and value. But no, somehow you can't find any worth or value in God's opinion of us in as far as a radical secular humanist goes, correct?
Yeah, you can't really find – a lot of secular humanists want to affirm that we have objective value. But when you begin to read them, they begin to understand and they begin to unravel that, look, we've searched for this in an objective sense without God, and it simply doesn't happen. I mean, I quote Stephen Jay Gould, the noted paleontologist and evolutionary biologist, who says that human meaning and higher answers just don't exist. They just don't exist. And this is, in his words, superficially troubling, if not terrifying, but ultimately liberating and exhilarating. I'm not sure how exhilarated you should be that there's no answers to life. But he says we have to create these things from our own ethical sense and our own wisdom. There is no other way. Mm. Richard Dawkins, in a very, frankly, candid and honest statement, says this: human beings are simply machines for propagating DNA. Mm. It is every living object's sole reason for living.
Wow.
Now, if I were to ask anybody, what's your purpose in life? Is that what you think of in an objective sense? You're a DNA machine? And my kids, I certainly hope, aren't DNA machines. So the problem is, when you look at things from a real, honest standpoint, you begin to see that the secular humanist who wants to affirm human value and dignity has a really hard time actually doing so. Kai Nielsen, the famous atheist, he also says the same thing, that he says, we have not been able to show that reason requires the moral point of view, or that really rational persons should not be individual egoists or classical amoralists. This reflection on this depresses me, but pure practical reason, even with a good knowledge of the facts, will not take you to morality.
Mm.
But the Bible does. The gospel does. And so, you know, I wrote the whole book from the perspective of something that Blaise Pascal, the famous scientist, philosopher, and Christian, said. He said, men despise religion. They hate it and are afraid it may be true. The cure for this is to first show that religion is not contrary to reason, but worthy of reverence and respect. Next, make it attractive. Make good men wish it were true, and then show that it is.
Mm.
I think if we do that as apologists, if we say, I understand and I affirm your grand central question, it's a good question, it's the right question, let me show you how the gospel can help answer it. Now you're affirming them and telling them you're valuable and I care about your question, and I think I found an answer for you.
Wow, that is beautiful. My guest is Abdu Murray. He is the author of this new book, Grand Central Question. And this is the Faith Radio Network. It's 11:46. I'm Bill Meyer. We're going to take a quick break. And if you haven't called us yet with your contact info, please do that, because we have three copies of Abdu's book to give away. If you call us at 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH, and we'll put you into that drawing for one of those books at the end of the hour. We'll take this quick break and be right back on the Faith Radio Network.
It's not just information, it's transformation.
A lot of things have kind of gone on in the last year or so, the last few years, actually. I just needed something different. Just kind of was poking around, and I found it. It's a reassurance that the Lord is there with me. Listening to the messages all day long, it brings peace to my day. Not only that, I mean, I've been educated. He's there all day, all the time.
Connecting faith to life every day. Thanks for listening to Faith Radio. We're blessed to hear the stories.
God just has walked us miracle after miracle.
They're stories of God at work, and we're humbled when He uses something heard on Faith Radio to reach you where you're at.
I'm just so blessed by all your speakers. I just want to thank you for all that you provide.
Have you been impacted by what you've heard on Faith Radio? Would you share your story with us? Call our Faith Line to pass on your story today. It's 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH.
To live by faith means to put God first. We at Faith Radio are committed to helping you grow deeper in your walk of faith. So we hope you'll boldly commit to live by faith by signing up to receive your Live by Faith wristband today. You can find it on our website at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. It is the Live by Faith wristband, and it's yours free for the asking. Again, myfaithradio.com.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. We're talking about the new book, Grand Central Question, Answering the Critical Concerns of the Major Worldviews by Abdu Murray. Our guest today. He's also a radio host in Detroit and the head of his own ministry, Embrace the Truth International. And Abdu, we've got just about 10 minutes left. Let's dive into the other two major worldviews that you explore in the book, pantheism and Islam. What's pantheism's grand central question, and how does Christianity answer it?
Pantheism is a very, very broad worldview, which includes so many different iterations like Hinduism, Buddhism, Shintoism, Confucianism. But in the West here, it also includes things like the New Age and the new spirituality of Deepak Chopra and Eckhart Tolle and Marianne Williamson, and even things like Scientology. So all these various different views actually have some core tenets they have in common, including reincarnation, and including the idea that we have some kind of inner power or inner divinity or inner soul that is connected to the universe. And all of our suffering is essentially a manifestation of our illusion that we're merely human. So suffering is the result of the illusion of being of thinking that you're human, and we need to wake up from this state through either meditation or audits or whatever you want to call it, to realize our inner divinity, and that will help us to escape suffering. And that is really the central question for all pantheistic thought. How do we escape the cycle of suffering? And you see that from all the writings, from especially here in the West, from the Deepak Chopras and Eckhart Tolle and all these folks, they write about this. So this is a central question. How do we escape suffering? And what their answer is to meditate or do good things or think right thoughts, and eventually you'll come to realize your own inner divinity, Deepak Chopra calls our gods in embryo. We're all gods in embryo. We're waiting to like be birthed, so to speak. And that's their way to get past the suffering issue. But it's interesting because Eckhart Tolle in his book The Power of Now tries to describe how we can enlighten ourselves out of our own pain. And here's what he says: enlightenment consciously chosen means to relinquish your attachment to past and future and to make the now the main focus of your life. In other words, don't look into the past, all your issues from the past, and don't get hung up on the future. Just focus on the now. And when you do that, you'll be free of pain. He says at the end of it, how much more pain do you need before you can make that choice? Now, it's interesting to me, because he says that life is suffering is an illusion, that you just need to let go of the past and stop worrying about the future, and you'll be enlightened into this sort of godhood that you are. And my question back to him is something like this: can you be serious? Can you really be serious? Can you look into the face of a parent who lost a child, for instance, in Newtown, Connecticut, and say, you know the pain you're experiencing? You're causing that yourself because you're hanging on to the past you had with your child, and you're anxious about the future you'll never see with that child. Just let it go and live in the now, and you'll be enlightened out of your own pain. How much more pain do you need before you can make that choice?
Wow.
Really? Seriously? How can you? I'm not going to paint him as cold and unfeeling, but come on. How is that possible that that's the answer to suffering? The gospel's juxtaposition here is that Jesus does not call your suffering an illusion. He does not say it's something that you need to wake up from. It's something that needs to be dealt with. Jesus, the man of action. Jesus, the incarnation of God, who knows our suffering. And not only does he know it, but he undergoes it himself. Historically, he undergoes the cross. And I think it always comes back to that, Bill. It always comes back to the cross. To me, the grand central answer to the grand central questions is that cross. He deals with suffering. He says, it's real. I'm willing to take it on myself. And then he rises from the dead to tell you there is no more sting to death. There is no more sting to sin and no more power. And that's, I think, the answer that the pantheist needs. If you want to escape suffering, you're not going to get rid of it in this life, because Jesus is honest. He says, you're going to have it, but I have overcome it eventually. You're not going to be reborn. You're going to be newly born. Mm. And that's the answer, I think.
Wow, that was a beautiful, very, very beautiful description there. In our remaining moments, let's talk about the religion of your birth, your youth, Islam, and what is its grand central question, and how does Christianity respond?
Well, you know, growing up, I always heard this phrase, and I always loved hearing this phrase when I was a Muslim. It's Allahu Akbar. Now, we always hear that in the West, and unfortunately, whenever we see it in the media, something explodes. You know, Allahu Akbar, then some kind of terrorist chant or something
right.
Kind of happens. This is not actually a terrorist chant. This is actually a statement that Muslims all over the world will use as a blessing and as a imploring of God to overcome their circumstances. It literally means in Arabic, God is greater. So he's greater than our circumstances. He's greater than the things we're even blessed by. God is so great to give us these blessings and these kind of things. So the central doctrine of Islam really is God's greatness. Every other doctrine of Islam flows from the central idea that God is truly great. Now, I, as a Muslim, rejected the ideas of the incarnation, the Trinity, the atonement, and the resurrection, because I thought these were doctrines that insulted God's greatness. How could God be great if he was triune, if he has partners, if the Holy Spirit and the Son are God's partners? How can this possibly be a great God, I thought? How could God be great if he became a man and limited himself in knowledge and power, and he had to sweat and sleep and do all these things? That's a great God, I would think. And my goodness, a God who dies at the hands of his own creation? This is a great God? Christians ought to stop thinking how great thou art and start thinking how great thou aren't. You know, that's what I would think.
Mm.
But then I began to look at these doctrines and see these are the very doctrines that don't insult God's greatness. They're the very doctrines that demonstrate it. I mean, God is great because he's triune. He's great because he's incarnate. In fact, because I know time is short, one of the things, again, it goes back to the cross for me. I believed Allahu Akbar, God is the greatest possible being as a Muslim, and I was searching for how could I understand him, and I saw something important, that God is the greatest possible being, and the Quran even says that God is loving. Well, if that's the case, if God is the greatest possible being, then he would love in the greatest possible way, and the greatest possible way to love is to self-sacrifice. We do it all the time. We do it for those we love, and we do it for strangers. But God's love is greater, and Romans chapter 5, verse 8 tells us this, that while we were yet sinners, God's enemies, Christ died for us. So he didn't die for those who love him. He died for those who hate him. So if God is the greatest possible being, he would love in the greatest possible way. And the greatest possible way to love is self-sacrifice. And I've looked high and low, and I've only found the God who gives of himself at the cross. And that's the gospel.
You know, you said something that surprised me there, that the Quran actually describes God as loving, because what I've heard in the past, and maybe this is erroneous, that there is so much emphasis on God's holiness in Islam, but very little on his love. So is that something that, would you say, most Muslims understand, that he is? Do they see him as loving?
Well, they see him as loving conditionally, of course, and sort of differently. See, the Quran has these things called the 99 beautiful names of God, and it's got these 99 attributes that describe God. Islam focuses so much on God's greatness and his transcendence, not necessarily his holiness. In fact, the word holy is only used twice in the entire Quran. But it does center on his greatness and his mercy and all these things. But one of the names for God, of the 99 names, is Al-Wadud. Al-Wadud literally means full of loving kindness. But the Quran repeatedly says he is full of loving kindness only to those who love him first.
Got it.
So he loves not the sinner. He loves not the rebellious. He only loves the righteous.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So they're constantly trying to earn his love and earn his mercy, which, interestingly enough, is oxymoronic, because you can't actually earn mercy. Mercy, by definition, is what you don't deserve, and earning is what you do deserve, so you can't earn mercy,
That
which is why we need grace, which is why we need the cross.
Wow. Amen to that. Well, this has been a great discussion. I know we've just scratched the surface of your book, but I want to encourage our listeners to pick up a copy of it. Once again, it's Grand Central Question, Answering the Critical Concerns of the Major Worldviews by Abdu Murray. And we've got about 30 seconds left. Give us your website, if you would, Abdu.
Sure. It's embracethetruth.org. And they can get the book at embracethetruth.org/GCQ. And there's some free bonus content there as well that they can sign up for.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for your work, for your life, your ministry. And may God continue to open doors for you and use you in ways perhaps you never even expected.
Well, thank you so much. And the same to you as well.
Abdu Murray, our guest here on the Faith Radio Network, thank you for joining us, and we encourage you to stick around. We've got Neil Stavem coming up next with his Connecting Faith rebroadcast, one of his best of programs from the week. And if you'd like to get our entire weekend broadcast schedule, just go to myfaithradio.com and click on the weekend schedule. Have a wonderful weekend. I will see you back next Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Central here on Faith Radio.